What's up, Duke fans? Welcome to the Devil's Den podcast. First off, Happy New Year's. It's your host, Josh Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Shu and Raul, and we also have Steve Clark today. As you're aware, you know, we've had some canceled games recently, so we thought we'd do kind of a year-in-review podcast and maybe jump into Georgia Tech briefly. Hopefully that game's going to get played. As of right now, it looks like it's going to. But when we talk about those games that have been canceled, I guess, is there a slot that you guys think, I know, Shu, you were looking at the schedule. Is it possible to reschedule this game at this point?
I mean, yeah, I think it certainly is possible. The question is whether we want to do it or not. Right now we're playing at Louisville Saturday, January 29th, and we won't play again for a week when we go play at Carolina. So in between that, we could certainly fit it in. A lot of people have looked at Monday, January 31st. Clemson also would have that day available. The problem is, the biggest problem is that's three away games for us in a row if we do it that way with the short turnaround of a Saturday, Monday that we already don't want. And then you're fitting something in the week of the rivalry game with Carolina, right? Like typically we take a couple days before that first game with Carolina. As far as Clemson's outlook of it, they would play us Tuesday, January 25th at Cameron. And then if we played them on the 31st, it'd be back-to-back games against Duke for Clemson. So not sure if that actually happens, but looking at the schedule, I didn't see many other spots for it to fit in. So I guess going from there, it's the question of, do we really want to reschedule it? And for me, there would be a quad one game right now as it stands. I think Clemson's 52nd in the net. So that would give us a quad one opportunity. But then again, like I said, with the three, if it went that date with the three away games in a row, you just kind of run that risk. Like, I don't know if it is worth it or not. What do you guys think?
Well, it's like I was talking to John, and we're basically, all we can do now is lose a one seed pretty much, right, with the ACC, sure, right? There's not a ton of games of quality, so it sucks to lose one, but I'm not sure if I want to add one right before Carolina either. I don't know. I mean, Raul, what are you thinking on that? Is it worth it to reschedule these?
I mean, that's already a tough turnaround at Louisville and then at UNC. And we tend to have a habit of looking ahead to that UNC game. So it would definitely worry me from a competitive perspective. And it sounds like Clemson would have the competitive advantage there because they would have more time off before that game and they would have just played us. So they would have seen us and then they could game plan accordingly and they'd be at their house. So I'm not saying you should turn down a game because it would be hard, but like you said, there's not necessarily a great advantage to it. But on the other hand, how many games can we miss and still get a one seed? Like, what if we play, you know, 20 total games? Right. Is that still acceptable in the committee's eyes? I don't know. But
well, you think back to last year, and I don't know. I mean, we canceled those three non-conference games, right? And in the end, when we're 13-11, those were three easy wins. You're 16-11 at that point. Maybe we don't miss the tournament had we not just canceled those games. You know, I don't think that's a big deal this year. We're obviously on track to make the tournament. It's all about the one seed for us again. And as you alluded to, Josh, it's kind of ours to lose at this point. So it's a risk reward thing, right? Like,
yeah. And I think, Steven, you can back me up on this or not. It didn't really seem like, and I know last year was its own entity, but it didn't seem like we were very aggressive in trying to reschedule canceled games last year. And I don't know if that's going to look the same this year. We've already done it once, but maybe that's just something to keep in mind as well.
Well, and that's the hard part, because the dynamics, the difference between canceling non-conference game versus conference games. And I think that's where my big question is, like in terms of the conferences, the ACC's influence in all this, because correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but the two games so far that Duke hasn't been able to play in conference, those games were postponed, right? Like officially, they weren't canceled. And so I think the dynamic is, like, it seems like because the conference said, you know, the games are postponed, it seems like there's an expectation there that we're going to reschedule these games. And if that's the case, if that's the thinking, then you have to figure whenever those games get rescheduled, I think it's just going to be a reality of, is there an open window where this can work? But at the end of the day, if you're the ACC, like from a conference perspective, you could see them wanting those games to be played and schedule whenever you can make it happen, because you think about, you know, the financial interest at work in terms of how many ACC teams make it to the NCAA tournament. Like, the, just from a big picture perspective, like that's an influence to think about, right?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, Clemson's going to want to play that game, right? An opportunity to boost their resume. They're not going to have many in conference. Duke is the biggest resume booster possible for them. So they're going to be incentivized. The ACC is going to be incentivized. Duke may not be incentivized, but does that matter if there's enough external pressure? I guess that's what you're saying.
I think there's that. And I also think, too, at the end of the day, and I think I'm probably going to reference this line from Paolo Banchero quite a bit this year. Like, I love when Paolo earlier this year said, we're going to play like Duke. And I think Duke this year, both from a player perspective and a coaching staff perspective, knowing that this is K's last year, I know they won't say anything publicly, but you know those guys as a group, they want to ball out this year. They want to play as hard as they possibly can, have as many good wins as they possibly can, and make a statement in the NCAA tournament. So from a motivation perspective, like, I don't even question whether or not Duke wants to play that game. I think they want to play. I think it's just a matter of like the scheduling quirks and the details, you know, all that stuff has to be worked out, and there's going to be a plan there, I'm sure. But I just don't have any questions about whether or not those games are going to be played if they're able to like work out an equitable schedule.
I don't know if you guys realize, but, you know, this year started out the same as last year. I think last year our first two games were canceled or postponed right after the new year. So it's a new year, but kind of same old same in that regard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess that's a good enough segue as we're going to get to talk about some of the this year in review as we start with the 2020 team. You know, 10-9 record after January 1st, didn't finish very strong, ended up 13-11, 9-9 in conference. We did see them finish out in the ACC tournament, but I guess I'll send it to you, Raul, first. What's your kind of takeaways from that season?
I mean, there's a lot that you kind of block out of your mind as a fan. There are some high points that stick in my mind, though, and I try to look back on those and kind of understand the circumstances that they were playing in, which were definitely very difficult. But I would say one big thing that I remember is the Virginia win. That was a really great game. And then also, of course, Mark's emergence at the end of the season was a big thing. That gave us something to look forward to in this year, you know. So it was a kind of bittersweet season in a way, because most of it was bad, but then towards the end, you got this hint of things to come.
Yep.
Yeah, and I think it started in the summer too with that group. You know, like this, I don't know, Steve, I don't think everybody even got to campus until almost like August or something last year. Yeah, they didn't have no summer work. I mean, and
it was hard. It was hard. And I think you guys, I don't know if you remember it or not, but after this past season, I had the opportunity to talk with Mark Williams's parents, and we did a pretty candid interview with them. And I think from an emotional perspective, that's the thing that I took away from listening to them, was just, they talked about it from the perspective of Mark, but you could see it like with the whole team, like it was a very emotional, you know, emotionally difficult season for everybody because of the quarantine requirements, not being able to play in front of fans. And I think that to me is the biggest takeaway, was, you know, that team mentally and emotionally last season had to fight through a lot of adversity in a variety of different ways. And I think that to me, especially with Mark Williams, I'm glad that Raul mentioned Mark, because Mark had the biggest room for growth coming off of last season because of how well he came on at the end of the season. And I think that's one of the biggest reasons why I have such respect for him this year, because he came back with unfinished business. He wanted to have the experience of being a Duke basketball player in front of the fans. And he wanted to put in the work to be, you know, a guaranteed starter, which he is. I mean, he's one of Duke's most important players this year. And I think the experience of last year, I think, propelled guys like Mark and like Wendell, like Jeremy, you know, Joey Baker. Like, you could just tell after that season, like, they wanted to put forth their best effort this offseason to be prepared for this season because of how rough it was last year.
Yeah, I mean, that was my biggest takeaway from last year, was just the pandemic, no fans in the stands. I mean, it was just the eeriest thing to watch a basketball game. And the team has to, to hype themselves up, they have to provide all their own energy. And it was just I'd mentioned the Jalen Johnson, that huge dunk on PJ Hall. I mean, there's nobody there to see it. You don't really get a boost off of it. It's on to the next play after that. And there were a lot of games that we went into overtime with Georgia Tech. That Louisville game at home was close. And I think those are games that we probably win, or at least fare better in, with our normal home court advantage. And we weren't the only people that dealt with that. I mean, other teams, Kansas, Kentucky, Michigan State, there were other programs that kind of felt the effect of not having fans in the stands. But us being as young as we were, I think that was a really big part into why we had the kind of the lackluster record that we did.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned youth, because I was actually going to bring that up. I think with all the challenges of last season, we might have done a little bit better if we hadn't been so young. There was kind of a leadership void there, right? Moore has emerged as a leader this year, but last year I wouldn't say we had a clear-cut leader. I mean, I guess Goldwire maybe to an extent, but it's not the same. This year you can really feel Moore's and even Baker's leadership.
Yep.
And I think we have to talk about Matt Hurt just briefly, talking about last year. And I think, to me, that was one of the biggest casualties of this thing, is it's so rare for Duke fans to have that like fringe freshman come back. And then we get it, and then you have it at that kind of season. And he played really well last year. I mean, obviously there was some defensive stuff, but when he was on, it was fun to watch. I mean, he had that mid-range shimmy, turnaround, every three from the corner seemed automatic at one point. And for him not to really get that experience, I think of like a guy like Grayson Allen, sophomore season, Trey Jones, sophomore season. There's excitement when that recruit comes back for us. And then, last year just didn't really deliver for him or for us. But any thoughts on Matt Hurt from anyone else?
Wasn't Matt our first top 15 recruit to come back as a sophomore? And at least in a while, right? I think that was a stat I saw going around that we hadn't had somebody.
I'm trying to remember what with Trey Jones. I'm trying to remember what he was ranked.
He was right outside of 15, what, like 16. It might be a caveat. Matt was 12th and Trey was 16. So
I mean, obviously.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, obviously, Singler, but that's a long time ago. So you're probably right.
In the one and done era, I would say, past 2010.
Yeah. Right.
No, I have a lot of respect for Matt Hurt for what he did in the offseason going into his second year at Duke, because I think whenever you don't have the season that you want as a high ticket freshman, which happens to lots of high ticket freshmen all around the country, a lot of times it'd be really easy for those guys to have people in their ears and say, just go pro, you'll be fine. Get to the league, show your game. And for Matt Hurt to come back, I mean, in the way that he did, he clearly committed himself in the offseason to working on his body and working on his game. And I think to go into a sophomore year where, with all the emotional challenges that playing through a COVID season faced, like, for him to be ready to produce as one of Duke's best players night in and night out, like, I just have such respect for him with that, because it takes such mental focus in the offseason to prepare your game in every way to fulfill those expectations, to be the lead, to be the offensive leader of a team. I mean, you have to put in the work to do that. And he definitely did that. So, he's one of those guys that during the course of the season, you knew when Duke needed a bucket, he knew, he was confident that he could be in position to play that role. And that came from hard work for him.
Yeah, I would add on to that. I think it's, extra props for him for it, because his freshman year was kind of up and down for him, right? It was almost like a Luke Kennard's freshman year. You see flashes in games, but then the game, he's just kind of not even there. So it was, I think that he was a freshman with Vernon, right? So it was kind of Vernon. We had Jack White in there a lot of times. So Hurt was kind of in and out. And then to come back, like you said, Steve, as a sophomore and just be the man. I mean,
it's not, it's not easy to do, guys. I mean, it takes a special focus, you know, to become that kind of player.
Sure. And go ahead, bro.
Sorry. I was going to ask Steve, something occurred to me. So you're talking about Hurt returning, but of course, at the end of this last season, we had an unusual number of departures. And I was wondering if you thought that was kind of tied into the whole emotional toughness of the COVID situation, because there was DJ Stewart, Hurt, obviously, Brakefield, and Coleman transferred, Goldwire transferred, Jalen Johnson opted out. I don't know if that had anything to do with that, but we could talk about him a little bit too.
I think each of those situations was unique. And I know that's that sounds like a cop-out, but each of those situations for why those guys left to wherever they went was for a wide variety of reasons. You look at a guy like DJ Stewart, I think he very clearly had some people that were, you know, around him who were like, you need to go, you know, opportunity is now. And he chose to go. And I think, you know, the other thing you have to keep in mind too is like when you play a Duke, you know, and say you transfer, you know, like you look at guys like Henry Coleman, Jamin Brakefield, like, you know, that if you're in line to be a guy who returns, you know, as a second or third year player, you know, very likely that because of the level that Duke recruits at, that they are going to have at least one, if not more guys coming in who will play at a, whether it be position, role, what, you know, the cream of the crop is coming in every single year. Right. So for some guys, you know, they choose to say, I'd rather go to a place, you know, from a transfer perspective that I know maybe I'll have a little bit more of an opportunity over the long haul of my career, as opposed to, you know, staying at Duke, you know, as a junior or a senior. And I don't say that to like demean those guys. Like, I have respect for Jamin Brakefield and Henry Coleman and all those guys who transferred to other places, because at the end of the day, when anybody makes a decision to leave, they're doing it in the best interest of them and their families. And I think if you feel like I have a better opportunity for myself at someplace else to maybe show more of my game, have more consistent playing time, like, I get that. Like, guys are going to leave. That's the reality of the transfer portal in today's NCAA. So, but the Jalen Johnson was a completely different situation from those guys. I think he came in knowing like he was a for sure one and done guy. And I think because I think Jalen, how do I put it? Like, Jalen came in with high expectations that I think he was going to be the man at Duke. And I think he had the capability in his game to be the man. But if you're going into Duke to be the man, like, you also have to know that the coaching staff is going to challenge you to be the man in every single way. And they're going to do that because that's how they help you grow, to both be the man at Duke and prepare you for the NBA. Because if you're that ability level, the coaches know we can get more out of you if you're willing to let us get it out of you. And I think with Jalen, I think he wanted to be the man. And I think, like with other freshmen in the past who, you know, it's their freshman year, they're playing for Coach K, they're learning how to play at a higher level, mentally, discipline, energy, effort, all those things. Sometimes those guys go through rough patches at Duke. And I think with him, you know, there was a variety of factors why he chose to leave. But for me, I think part of the reason why he left was, I think he just wanted to prepare himself for the draft in the way that he saw fit, and difficult situation.
Yeah. And I think COVID does like play a small role in why we saw so many, because like all of those guys we mentioned outside of Jalen were probably all guys that we would peg as those candidates to be a sophomore at Duke, to be a junior at Duke. Oh, yeah. And I think if the basketball thing's not really working out very well for you, especially last year, there's nothing else holding them there. They're like quarantined in Washington Duke. They're not on campus. They're not like out. You're not making those college friends and doing all that. So, and maybe that outweighs some of this stuff normally, right? Maybe you don't lose a Brakefield. Like, I could see Brakefield totally playing a role in this team. Maybe we don't go get Theo John, but Brakefield or Coleman, either one could have played that 5 to 8 minutes that we're seeing, right?
I think Brakefield ended up going to Ole Miss, which, you know, when he picked Duke, you know, Ole Miss was definitely an option for him out of high school. And I think he kind of saw after that first year at Duke, you know, I think he probably was aware that, you know, hey, I'm going to have an opportunity to kind of be the man, you know, in some ways at Ole Miss. And I think he probably knew, like, at Duke, you're going to be a part of the rotation, you're going to play. But I don't know if he felt like I'm going to get the opportunity to be the man, given who was coming in, especially at his position.
Yeah. Loved his game, though. Loved his game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Crafty. He was crafty.
Yep.
I mean, that Virginia game that you mentioned earlier, Raul, was our best game. You know, Jamin was huge in that iconic, you know, and one picture that we had of, you know.
And you know what? I mean, I know this is probably an add-on thought, but given all the reality of the guys who chose to leave, I think that further impressed upon Wendell Moore the importance of this offseason for him. And I think the reality that Wendell saw, not just of the possibility of additional playing time, but I think Wendell saw after last season and all the departures, I think he saw, and I'm sure this was communicated to him from the coaching staff, like, we need you to take a step. And I think because the opportunity was there, he combined that with, I mean, probably one of the best off seasons of development that we've seen for any Duke upperclassman in recent history. So if those other guys, if they were there, like, do we see the same jump? You know what I'm saying? I think Wendell focused this off season in a completely new way, changed his body, changed his aggressiveness, and it's paying off for him and it's paying off for Duke because he's one of their best guys this year.
Yep. Sure. Yep. And a guy that came in with one and done expectations on him, at least for himself, right? Maybe that wasn't something that was like out there, but I remember interviews when he was recruited as it wasn't denied either. It was like, well, if that's available, I'll look at that. But I think he unpacked his bags, but it's good to see that, you know, junior year Wendell, here we are.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Absolutely.
I was just going to say one of my things about Jalen and we were speaking on Matt. That was kind of a kind of a weird fit with those two together. Was it not? Like, they're both kind of fours. You can't play Matt at the five, or he can't guard a five. He's not going to guard a three. And so it was kind of a redundancy at the four spot. And I think in hindsight, if I would have known that Jalen was going to opt out in February, I kind of wish we wouldn't have had him at all, where maybe Mark plays the whole year and we have a different year. But then again, if Mark plays the whole year, maybe he's gone this year too. So it's,
I'll admit, I really thought when Jalen Johnson committed to Duke, and once I saw that he was going to be playing with Matt, I thought offensively those two were going to be really good, because I scouted Jalen from when he was a sophomore in high school. And I loved his passing ability. I loved his ability to get downhill and find guys. And I thought him and Hurt were going to pair well together offensively, because they're both versatile guys. Again, I thought pick and roll was going to be a nightmare with those two. I think the hard part with the match at Duke was more was defensively. Like, they, you know, I think they were both playing out of position on defense, and they didn't complement each other super well defensively. And I think once Jalen left and you saw Mark Williams kind of take a step forward, that's where I think you saw the Duke's defense take a little bit of a jump, because Mark, you know, the position that he naturally plays, he could complement, you know, Matthew Hurt a little bit better with that 4-5 combination than I think defensively Matt and Jalen did, which, you know, that's how it goes.
Well, I think that's a perfect segue into, you know, Mark breaking out, because like you said, once Jalen was kind of out of the picture, we were forced to bring Mark in, slot him into that five spot. And, you know, he had a double-double against Syracuse, 18 points, 11 rebounds. Of course, that huge game in the ACC tournament against Louisville with 23 and 19. I mean, that was a way to end the year.
Oh, yeah. You should have heard his parents when I was talking to him in that postseason interview, when we got to talking about that Louisville game, like, just the excitement that they and Mark had over that game and what it portended for the future. Like, the light clicked on for him in that game. Like, you could tell, like, once he decided to come back, like, he knew, I'm going to be able to be a dominant player, and I'm looking forward to being able to do that.
Well, can I ask you this real quick, Steve? How close do you think Mark came to not coming back, though? Because I know Raul and Josh and I, we fret every summer about who's leaving, and I thought we all came to the conclusion, like, look, if Mark goes to the combine, I mean, he's going to test through the roof. I mean, with the way he runs, he can catch the ball. Like, I think he could have been
I think he I think there was definitely consideration of it, but I also, having talked with his parents in the off season, I do give credence to what they said that, you know, when I asked them, like, how serious do you think it was? And I got to remember back to the article, like, I think they recognize the value for Mark in staying for year two at Duke, knowing that he was going to have an opportunity to play a primary role on the team. And I think they thought if Mark had gone pro after year one, he probably would have been drafted, you know, maybe late first round, maybe early second round. And I think he had the physical tools, but I think they recognized, and I think this is a similar consideration that Wendell Moore had, where if you come back for year two, like Mark did, and year three for like Wendell did, knowing that you're going to be the man and you're going to have an increased role, like that's going to give you an opportunity to show more of your game. And I think at the end of the day, Mark made, and as you know, with his family, made a really smart decision for himself, because you've seen him play on the biggest stage in the biggest games and be one of Duke's best players this year, despite all the other talent that they have on this team. And I think they recognize that this season, by him coming back, he stood to gain more for his NBA prospects because he was going to be in a position to play every night, be a featured guy, you know, have an important role on the team. And I don't think you can discount that. You know, I think they recognize the value of it.
Well, he's also a little bit of a legacy recruit. So I wonder how much that plays into it. You know, his sister was here. She was here all 4 years, and like she got the experience and he saw that secondhand. And last year he didn't really get that experience. You know, he, you know, I imagine he went and saw games that she played in Cameron and, you know, was excited about experiencing that himself. And then he comes to Duke and there's a global pandemic, you know? So,
yes. No, that's such a good point. And I think that was definitely a part of the consideration. Like he wanted to have that full Duke basketball player experience. And now he's been able to get that so far this season. But I definitely do think, because the big difference for me between Mark and his sister, Mark was in position to go pro after year one, like he could have. And right. I think for him, I never thought that he was coming into Duke to be a 4 year guy, just to be honest, just based on his progression, especially as a junior and senior in high school. But I think coming back for year two, I think he expected to come back, you know, and kind of be the man and play hard and have a big role. And he's shown himself capable.
Yep. And we'll talk a little bit about that when we talk about what we're looking forward to. Cause I will say that based on how he ended last season, I'm still kind of waiting on that version of Mark, that super engaged. Right now, we've seen it in flashes, like Gonzaga game. He was just excellent. And part of it, I think, might be a little bit on him. But I think another part is just staff still trying to figure out, how do we use Paolo and Mark together? And like, what is that going to do? How do we keep him on the floor in games where they're trying to play him off? Hopefully, we'll figure that out and we'll get to see that kind of, you know, I don't see why he shouldn't be a double-double guy nightly. So hopefully we get to see a little bit more of that. But well, I guess we can't talk about this year without mentioning Kay's retirement. I think that was the story that kind of dominated the summer for the most part. You know, I had like friends and family members texting me, asking me if I'm okay, if it's, you know, like every, it's the fallout of losing Kay. And I'll toss it around. But I think for me, it wasn't as bad as I was thinking it was going to be. And I think that's because of how they did it. And then having John step right in after it made it seem like, okay, well, this is still Duke. This is still us. You know, it's not like bringing in a Chris Beard or even a Brad Stevens might have been well received, but it would have been such a drastic shift. Whereas the way they did it made it seem like very natural, organic. And I don't know, Steve, do you have any kind of thoughts on just how Duke did that or your takeaway?
Yeah, I'm interested to hear your guys' thoughts on it as well. I think the big thing for me that, I mean, obviously we knew that this day was coming, you know, at some point in the near future before the announcement happened. But I think for me, like, I think about a lot of things from the perspective of recruiting. And I think I was, once the announcement was made that it was going to be John, I was just, at that point in time, I was fascinated to see where was recruiting going to head, both from the perspective of how was John going to approach either in a similar way or in a different way to building classes and what was the reception going to be from recruits? And I think we've kind of seen a pattern now, and we could talk about it if you guys want to. Like, there's a pattern there where I think John has kind of picked up the baton and run with it. And I think you've kind of seen players willing to say, I want to be a part of history. I want to be a part of John Shire's first class as a head coach at Duke. And I think also from a recruiting perspective, the fascinating thing to me is the parallels between Duke football and Duke basketball, where, you know, you're dealing with a coaching change immediately at Duke football and how that recruiting class kind of stayed together. And then you're dealing with a changing in head coaches next year under Shire, but how that impacted recruiting for him in this 2022-2023 class. But I'll stop there. I want to hear your thoughts, guys.
Well, I think, like Josh said, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. And part of that is, like you're saying, the recruiting. The fact that he's been able to not only maintain, but if anything, up our recruiting has been a huge reassurance, because that gives you such a leg up as a coach, right? Coach K didn't start winning until he got the class with Dawkins and all those guys, you know, and Billis and who else was in that class? I can't even remember, but you know, I was 6 years old at the time, but but having that foundation of talent just gives you such an advantage as a young coach. You know, yes, he studied under K and he knows a lot and he's a very smart guy, but he's still going to have some growing pains, you know, running the team by himself. So the fact that he's been able to keep landing these five stars and if anything, you know, like we did a recruiting podcast with John Watson, and Josh mentioned that this might end up being Duke's best class. You know, that's high praise. I mean, you know, but if not best, it's, you know, going to be in the top five probably.
From a rankings perspective, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then just fit too. I like how Shire's been recruiting. He's still recruiting the top talent, but it seems like there's a little bit more focus on fit. And far be it from me to criticize Kay, but if I had any complaint about recruiting the last 4 years, it just seemed to be like, sometimes it just seemed like a grab bag of five-star guys, and you know, we'd end up with a team with no shooting or whatever, or we'd end up with a team with no big man, or just some key and somewhat avoidable hole on the roster. And it seems like Shire is really the biggest shift I've seen once he kind of took over recruiting for himself, was a little bit more balance.
Yeah, and I think he benefited in some ways. John has benefited in a lot of ways from his history as an assistant coach, an associate head coach, for a lot of the things that you're touching on, Raul. Like that whole dynamic of Duke having to recruit an increasing number of the top shelf elite guys in every single class because they had to bring in freshman class. Like, you could really kind of trace the effects of that going all the way back to the recruitment of the class of like Chase Jeter, Kennard, Frank Jackson, because I think Duke, when they first started doing the one and done recruitment era, I think they didn't want to do like that, have to have like a group of five or a group of six one and done that you knew were all going to leave. I think they wanted to recruit, you know, maybe one or two a year, but given the reality of guys leaving, you know, whether it be a Tyus Jones leaving after a year, Justice Winslow, or any of those guys that I just mentioned, like, because those guys put themselves in position to leave after 1 year, Duke had to play catch up in a lot of ways and recruit a group of higher level talented guys that were elite, each in their own fashion, that each year was a new year in terms of trying to construct the roster and trying to build cohesiveness. That's a really hard thing to do when you're bringing in that level of talent and that volume of talent every single year. Whereas, and so I think John saw that, and I think he saw what it took to recruit at that level, you know, from learning under Jeff Capel and then taking the reins himself and becoming the lead recruiter for guys like Tatum and Jalen Johnson and so many other top flight guys that have come in. And I think he learned from that experience, and like looking forward a little bit, I think he learned that for him, knowing that he's building his initial classes for both next season and the seasons to come, I think he saw it. I want to, you know, maybe try to build a roster where maybe there's a few guys that we know for sure are going to go one and done, but I'm going to try to build balance. And I think he did that, number one, because it's in his own interest as the new head coach to like try to have as much continuity early on and build that veteran leadership in your new program. But I think he also learned that there's a way to kind of balance your roster if you're willing to take guys that both fall into that surefire, no-brainer, one-and-done group and guys that you think have the potential to be there two, and also the desire to be there 2, 3, and 4 years.
Yeah, I think we started out that way. You know, when we recruited Kyrie, wasn't that Josh Harrison and Tyler Thornton in that class as well? And then the next year was Alston, but had Quinn Cook, Gbenegé. Yeah.
Gbenegé was in that class.
Alex Murphy. No, the big change happened with I think Justice Winslow and Tyus Jones going after year one, and then
you
the
had
following
Ingram,
year
Luke,
with
Chase Cheater. Yep.
Well, then 17 was the mass exit. So you had those two major mass exodus, right? 15 and 17, and then pretty much it's like, well, in order to stay at the top, in order to have kind of a ceiling as a championship contender, now we have to go bring four guys in that can play.
And the other thing too, like you think about the dynamics of 2018 when they brought in, you know, the Zion class. Mm-hmm. Like the reality of that class was those four guys with Trey, RJ, Zion and Cam Reddish, like those guys recruited each other. Like they wanted to play together. Like, yes, Duke was recruiting them, but they wanted to play together. Like, if you're Duke, you're not going to turn down an opportunity to bring in a class like that. Like, there's just, especially if they all want to play together. But the flip side is like we're talking about the roster continuity. It's just really hard to do that when you're bringing in that volume of high level NBA talent. Like, they're going to want to go.
Yeah. Well, real quick before we head over to the next topic, you know, I just wanted to give my thoughts on Coach K retiring. You know, I was born in 1984, so my entire life, Coach K is Duke to me. You know, that's like we've said, it's kind of a bittersweet thing. You knew the day was coming. Just would you be prepared for it? And I was a little shocked, I have to say, when I heard that he was going to retire at the end of this year. I kind of assumed that he would stay through Severino graduating. I kind of thought he'd see that out. But, you know, a lot of stuff was made of him doing it the way he did it. And I think we did it the perfect way because, again, it led to John being able to just get right on the recruiting trail. And we didn't really miss a beat. I think if he would have done it another way, kind of in the Roy Williams way, we would have felt a little cheated out of, you know, we didn't get to kind of see him and know it was going to be his last year. So I'm glad that he announced it in the way he did. And I know a lot's been made of this farewell tour or whatever the haters want to call that, you know. I really, you know, it is what it is. You know, people are going to say what they're going to say about it. I don't think he did it out of any, you know, vainness.
Well, and it happens across all sports. Let's throw that out there, right? Kobe got one. Chipper Jones got one. This is what you do for, you know, for guys like goat. That. Yeah.
That's
what you do.
I mean, well, you know, one of the things that just kind of came to my mind when I was thinking about the stuff that I was reading on Twitter from the haters is a lion doesn't concern himself with the opinions of the sheep. You know, that's Tywin Lannister's nice line. So don't really care what you guys think about it. Just deal with it. It is going to be glorious.
Yeah. Yeah. It does suck that these were his last, like that two out of the last three of his years are dominated by this COVID stuff. Yeah, last year, I'm not so sure what they would have done. I would have really liked to seen 2019-20 team in the NCAA tournament with Trey. Yeah. That's Trey sophomore year, Vernon Carey. We weren't title favorites, but, you know, I think we were, you know, in the handbag of teams that could make a Final Four.
I think the KenPom number, we had the magic, one of the magic numbers there to at least make a run for it, right? Like our offense and defense were both top 20 when we were heading into the
And we got robbed with J-Rob in the tournament. I mean, come on.
Oh, my goodness.
He was on fire.
Yeah.
Well, I think the decision to have K announce it and coach a final year part of that's his military background, right? Kind of idea of passing down the torch or this chain of succession or whatever.
No, that's crazy you bring that up, Raul, because I don't know if people know, but I grew up in an Army family. My dad, he did 25 years in the Army. He retired as a lieutenant colonel. And it's crazy you mentioned that, Raul, because that is a dynamic from a military perspective that not many people are talking about in relationship to this, because you're right. Like, I remember my dad, when I was in middle school, we were stationed in Germany, and there were two bases that we were on that he was the XO, the battalion XO. And I remember we were there for a year at one base and 2 years at a different base. And both of those, he was there to facilitate a leadership transition for guys that were coming in. And it's fascinating when you go through something like that, because you see how personal it is for the outgoing leadership person, whether it be the head of the battalion, you know, the second in command. It's a very personal thing for them to make sure that they finish out both as a leader of their unit, their battalion, in a good way. And a big part of that is transitioning, making sure that their successor is prepared and is ready to go so that they have success as the new battalion XO or whatever. And in some ways, I kind of see that with how Kay has kind of prepared Shire for that transition, because he, like everybody likes to say, you know, Kay gives his assistants, you know, a lot of leeway, a lot of opportunity to grow, take responsibility within the program. But you could just kind of see, like, Kay had a tremendous amount of trust in Shire that, you know, he told Shire, go out there and do recruiting. Like, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to stay here. And I trust you to go and do recruiting and not be around, you know, with the team, because I'm ready to do that. And you can go and build your future classes. Like, that takes a tremendous amount of trust on Kay's part to do. So that military dynamic is spot on, Raul.
And you even hear, I think, I don't know where I saw this, but I think I was hearing something about, like, even in timeouts during games, you'll see Kay talk and then Shire will talk, right? Like, it's almost kind of like this co-coaching thing that he's doing it with.
And I think before the season, Kay say something like Shire, just like Kay does. Shire does a scout for every single game. Like, he has the head coach scout, and him and Shire will have one-on-one meetings about every game, separate from the game planning meetings where they meet with either, you know, Nolan or with Carwell in terms of the game plan. So he's already helping him grow this season by, in some ways, treating him like a head coach, giving him that opportunity to have that voice the way he does now.
Yeah, he actually said that in I can't remember which press conference, but he mentioned that Shire was essentially a co-head coach now. So
yeah,
just to back up your point.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we're all, you know, equally excited about John, but before we get there, I guess we'll, you know, talk about the current team. You know, start of the season pretty well, right? In my opinion, we should be undefeated probably right now, but, you know, I think we'll all take it. Some pretty big wins, Kentucky, Gonzaga being the ones that stand out. I guess as we kind of preview going into next year, what are we hoping to see from this team? Is there another step we can take? What do you want to see more of? Maybe what do you want to see less of? I guess I'll start. For me, it's two things. It's, I want to see more of this version of Wendell Moore. I want to see him take this thing. I'd like to see him win Player of the Year. I'd certainly want him to I want him to win ACC Player of the Year. And the other one would be AJ Griffin. I think that's the player that, from a lineup standpoint, from a depth standpoint, from a flexibility standpoint, you know, this guy has lottery potential. And if we can see some of that at Duke, you know, I think it'll put us in a great position to be one of the final teams standing. But I'll send it to you, Shu, first. What are your thoughts kind of on the current team this year, and what are you looking forward to?
I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head there with same things I'm thinking. You know, AJ, come on, we obviously made a push to get him kind of acclimated those last couple games of the year before the break. And he showed up, and especially in that Virginia Tech game, and he was huge in that. So I think the things you mentioned, one of the things I guess I'm looking forward to, and I don't want to get too far down the line, is just, you know, how's this all going to play out in March? That's what we always we want to see the kind of the storybook ending, to be honest with you. And whether it happens or not, you know, you can't take away from the career that Coach K's had, but I am, you know, looking forward to finally getting back into the tournament. It's been a while since we've been there.
Mm. Well, I'm just trying to kind of appreciate the moment, because it's hard to win a title, right? We know this.
Yeah, sure.
You can have the best team and you can still lose. Right. I would argue we did in 2019, 1999, a lot of
2002.
Exactly. 2002, we didn't even make the Final Four. And we had
2006.
04.
Right. So the odds in any given season are against you. So for me, it's about a kind of appreciating that this is K's last moment and trying to sort of soak in every game. Now, that can be hard when we're down five or whatever, down seven against Virginia Tech, and I'm screaming and I'm enraged or whatever. But, you know, I've tried to go to more games this year, for one thing, and just sort of take in the atmosphere of Cameron. And then even when I've just been watching at home, I try to take a step back and remind myself, this guy's been coaching for my entire life. This is the last time I'm going to see him on the sidelines. Whatever happens this season, as long as the team kind of fights and plays hard, which they seem to be doing, and he seems to be fully engaged as a coach this year, which, you know, he's usually engaged, but there are years when I would say he's more dialed in with the team than others, like when he has some sort of special connection with them. And I don't know if he has a special connection, if I'd go that far, because we've only seen them play a few games so far, but it definitely seems like he likes this team and he's really willing to, you know, take some risks and try some things, which I'm appreciating.
I'm kind of like Raul, I would say. I think I'm trying to appreciate the moment and focus on the moment each game. And I think for me, the development of AJ Griffin is a huge one. I completely agree with that point that was raised earlier. I think we kind of saw in the last three games that Duke played that they have started the process of being able to have AJ be a key guy for them in the bench rotation. And I think that from a bigger picture perspective, I'll be honest, I'm not even thinking about the ACC tournament or the NCAA tournament. What I'm thinking about is Duke's road games this year, because I think we talked about this on the last podcast. Like every year we're used to seeing, you know, Duke face, you know, their opponent's Super Bowl every time they play them on the road. And it's going to happen again this year. And for me this year, I think this team has showed signs of being able to be one of Duke's most mentally tough, mentally disciplined teams out there that they've had. And that's going to show up, especially on the road. So I'm really fascinated to see when they're playing on the road in the ACC this year, they're taking that opponent's best shot. The crowd is rocking. Do they respond the way they did, like when they were in a close matchup in the second half against Gonzaga, where even when the pressure was on, Duke kept making play after play after play, and they showed how mentally tough they were? Because if they do, and I think they have the potential to do that, then I think we have the potential to see an historic regular season. Because winning on the road, I agree with Raul, it's hard enough in general to win in the ACC, but it's especially hard to win on the ACC in the road when you're going against really hostile environments. And that to me is the larger theme that I'm just looking forward to see how this team grows, because they're going to face adversity. And do they show their ability to respond to adversity on the road? That's not my biggest question, but it's what I'm looking forward to most see, because that's where I think they have the biggest room to grow and show who they really are as a team. They've shown signs of being a great team in mentally tough moments, but now they have an opportunity in conference to show that even more.
Yep. And I think, you know, that's a good segue as we get ready to jump into the GT preview. I will say too, and Steve brought this up offline, the impact of what this COVID could have on Duke, not in terms of the cancellation, we talked about that, but in terms of the physical impact on players. Yes. Are we going to be ready to go? Is there going to be any lingering? I think you mentioned Tatum as a guy that's been pretty open about, you know, hey, 6, 8, 9, 10 months later, not the same, right? So
and that could be the silver lining with that, could be the development, you know, the especially the post-development, like to have, you know, options like Theo John and AJ Griffin to be able to come off the bench, like to have flexibility in your lineup to where if you have a guy who maybe is struggling, like Tatum struggled, you know, with when he came off of COVID, like that Duke's depth could really be a big help to them, especially if any of the guys, you know, have any, you know, lingering after effects. I mean, I know we're talking about top flight athletes here, but I've just, you've seen it talked about so much with the NFL, with guys in the NBA like Tatum and others, like COVID can affect guys in different ways. So that's probably the other big question is like, how do these first couple games back, like how do the guys look physically, you know, because COVID, yeah. I mean, it's hard.
Yeah. And I think, you know, our depth is going to be a key strength for us. And I really like how the depth shakes out of like, to me, having those top eight guys is like the ideal. And I think we kind of might have a ninth and a Bates Jones or a Jalen Blakes, but having those eight guys, I'd like to see that continued going forward. Cause we've seen almost something from everyone in these last few games. You know, even Baker has been a guy historically who sometimes you don't even realize he's in the game. And this year he's had some moments, but every time he plays every game, he has at least a moment, I feel like, where he had that, you know, the and one where he dribbles in or he hits a big three or he's doing something. So I really hope that we see that going forward. And I guess we'll use that to jump into Georgia Tech. I'll send that to Raul. I'll be at the game if it happens. So, you know, pretty excited to be in the house for that. But what do you got for us, Raul, in terms of what we should be looking for?
Well, like you said, if it happens, right?
Yeah.
As of now, it's happening. I haven't seen anything about a cancellation, but, you know, we could find out tomorrow. So fingers crossed for you that you get to go.
Yep.
And of course, if you do go, you'll give us a in-depth kind of scouting report afterwards. And we'll have a podcast on that and the Miami game probably. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so looking at Georgia Tech, it's pretty rough. I'm not going to lie to you. we're favored 79-63, you know, so that's a large advantage for an ACC game. And when you start digging into their stats, you're almost surprised we're not favored more. I mean, they really have one good offensive player, to be honest with you. So they have Michael DeVoe, who, to be fair, is kind of an all ACC level player this year. So he can hurt you for sure, but there's a reason they're not a good offensive team. Everybody else has an offensive rating under 100. And just for comparison, Duke has eight players with an offensive rating over 100. Mm. And they would have nine, but Jeremy Roach is at 99.9, right? So he just missed the cutoff. Mm-hmm.
Oh, but just count it.
Yeah, okay. We round up. We'll call it nine. If he goes 4 of 6 in the next game, it'll be, you know, he'll be up to nine, right? But yeah, so DeVoe is a really good three-point shooter, shooting 46%. He's 6'5", so I figure he's a good matchup for Wendell Moore or even Keels. And this kind of seems like a tailor-made for Duke, right? To have a team with one good offensive player, and we have two guys who are really suited to guard him.
Yep.
And, you know, Kay loves to game plan to take the best player out of the game, right? So if we can do that, and I think Moore is fully capable. We've seen him play excellent defense all year. Keels as well is big and physical. So if we take him out of the game, we should win pretty easily because they won't have a shot at scoring if he's not on.
This should be a game, I think, where Duke hopefully is able to get out in transition. I think they have the capability to play, to have big numbers on the glass, both on the offensive end and defensive end. And if they can do that on the defensive end, I think Duke's transition game could be really important in a game like that. I think Georgia Tech, they lost their big guy, and they lost, I think it was at Alvarado, the point guard.
And Moses Wright. Yep.
Yeah. Losing those two guys was just huge. I mean, because those two guys were a big part of their success last year. But I think I look for a transition game this year, especially if Duke can control the glass like I think they can.
Being able to get out in transition would help get Mark more involved too. Because the last game was a little bit rough for him, not just defensively, but offensively, because Virginia Tech plays so slow Yep. He really didn't have a role there in the half court. They weren't allowing lobs over the top,
yep.
which meant that his only option would have been post-ups, and that's not really what Duke wants to run. We don't really want yep. back to the basket Mark Williams plays.
No, what you need to look, what I'm looking for with Mark is not even necessarily like a double-digit rebounding game, like I think he's capable, but if Duke sends Wendell Moore, Trevor Keels, even Jeremy Roach to the glass like they have been, Mark could have a field day and transition rim run to rim run. Because if their wings or even Apollo gets the rebound defensively, they can all pitch it up ahead. And we've seen Mark in the Gonzaga game, and he did a little bit in the Kentucky game too. If he can run rim run to rim run and be as aggressive and run as hard as he did in those games, he could have a field day with pitch aheads for offensive dunks in transition.
Yeah, it would definitely make me feel better about the team going forward if Mark were able to kind of reassert himself, because I feel like with AJ's emergence, Mark has kind of been pushed to the side a little bit, and I feel to reach our ceiling, we really need both of them at their A game, right? Because that flexibility to be able to switch lineups would be so huge for us going forward.
Yeah. What did you guys think about the development of AJ over the last three games? Because I agree. Like, I think his flexibility is a huge help to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think it completely changes the lineup, right? It completely changes the team. If he stays at what he's doing, it's really going to be interesting in how we distribute minutes. So far, we've seen it kind of push Mark out a little bit. I could see some situations where it actually ends up pushing like Roach or Keels' minutes down a little bit too, in certain kind of situations where we actually play a little bit bigger, with maybe AJ at the three, Wendell at the two, along with Paolo and Mark. But I think we need him. I think it's going to be, you know, I don't think we can win at all without him. I'll put it like that. I don't think we're going to hit our ceiling without him.
Yeah.
He showed some of those like Justice Winslow, like flashes of athleticism, like yeah. especially in the Virginia Tech game. I'd made a note of it. I think it was like 65, 62, but he's guarding Justin Mutz, who drives down the left side on him, and he recovers, blocks him, blocks it off the backboard. And as his momentum's carrying him across the backboard, he grabs the rebound off the backboard on the other side of the rim. Like it was kind of a crazy play. I've seen like, it's like go-go gadget arms to block this shot and then grab it from the other side.
Yeah.
I think he'd be huge for us. And that Justice Winslow comparison, I think John Watson had mentioned it in one of his write-ups after the Virginia Tech game, but that 2015 team kind of really changed its gear when we asked Emil to move to the bench and we brought, you know, Justice at the four, and then we kind of seen everything take off from there when we downshifted. So,
well, and I think that example is a really good one for this year's team, because even though Justice helped Duke kind of take off when they put him at the four and Emil went to the bench, who was one of the key players for Duke in winning that national championship? Yep. It was Emil Jefferson.
It was Emil, yeah.
And I think the same dynamic exists with AJ and with Mark. Because Mark, right. I love Mark with the starting unit, because all four of those guys outside of him in the starting unit can get the rebound and get out and push. And Mark this year, in my opinion, has been at his best when he hasn't had to be the primary rebounder. He's been able to get out in transition for what I was describing earlier, those rim run, pass ahead dunks or layups. That's where he's been his most dominant. And he can do that with that lineup. And then I love also the dynamic for Mark of he can play as hard as he can, as run as fast as he can for as long as he can. And then Duke can bring in two quality 4 or 5 options in AJ Griffin and Theo John. Like the post depth that Duke has complements each other. And just the fact that they could bring in two good players like AJ and Theo, I think that helps Paolo and helps Mark, because they know I can play as hard as I can. I can have a big role when I'm on the court, and I got help on the way. You know what I'm saying? Like, it helps everybody play their best because they complement each other. So not saying like other people think it's a bad thing that AJ or that Mark wasn't able to play the last few games as much because of AJ. I just think it was good for Duke as a team, because now they have four guys at that 4 or 5 rotation that complement each other so well.
And to Mark's credit, his body language looks good. You know, he's still making effort on defensive rotations. You still see him when he's on the bench, really, you know, cheering guys on and going kind of berserk when a walk-on makes a three or whatever. So, you know, it seems like he's still there with the team. He's not kind of dwelling on role or anything like that. And he shouldn't be, because like you said, he is going to have a big role going forward. It's just going to vary from game to game. He just might not play 30 minutes against certain teams, but he might play 30 minutes against a different team. So,
yep.
And as I kind of mentioned earlier, I think, you know, regardless of how his role kind of shakes out, you know, he's still got his NBA potential, right? Like, when he decides to go out and declare, I mean, he's going to test through the roof. He's going to be, you know, getting paid to play basketball the rest of his life. So I don't think he really has to worry about whether or not his minutes are cut back or what his stats are necessarily. You know, Corey Maggette came off the bench and was a lottery pick. So it's...
Yeah. And even if AJ continues to just come off the bench, I don't think we have to get peak version of AJ to reach our ceiling. If we can just get AJ good enough to play 20 minutes per game and be a 40% 3-point shooter, I think that immediately just bumps up what we got. And yep, he's shown that he's willing to take big shots and he can make big shots, both off the catch or kind of creating that himself. And I think that's what really, that's such a huge release valve. We're bringing that off the bench, you know,
absolutely
doing James Harden step back threes. And not just once, he's hit those like four times already. So it's in his bag. So,
yeah. And how many years have we just had no bench scoring? This is such a sort of pleasant change, right? To have really three guys off the bench who were major contributors, maybe not major scorers. Theo's not going to give you 15 points or whatever, but he's playing a role. You know, Baker's coming in. He's working his butt off. He's like,
oh yeah, I love what Theo brings, because he allows AJ to be AJ at the four. Because AJ isn't just going to be a guy who's only in the post. He's going to move around. He's going to curl. He's going to get after loose balls. Like, I love the fit of him and Theo. They play well together.
Well, I guess we've kind of went a little long here, but any final thoughts on the team this year, or Georgia Tech in particular, before we get out of here?
I was just going to say, as we move towards closing, I know there's been a lot of discussion on the Devil's Den about Duke's 2023 recruiting class. Just want everybody to know that's listening that we're for sure going to be doing a podcast probably in the future where we kind of look at in depth the 2023 class, both the guys that have committed and guys that Duke is serious with. I know there's questions about, you know, overlap and, you know, who are the guys that they're looking at? How are they going to play together if Duke gets a good portion of them? We're going to answer those questions. Don't worry.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else before we get out of here?
No, just looking forward to the rest of the season. So.
Yeah. And like Steve said, we're going to try to get the 2023 recruiting pod. We'll also likely do a Georgia Tech Miami reaction, assuming we get both of those games. So in the meantime, you know, head over to the boards, thedevilsden.com. Check us out there. We're all over there pretty actively. Shout out to John Watson. Hopefully he's able to get back safe and sound. But, you know, until then, keep the faces strong, the verve high. We'll see you next week.